we're back. Mailbag time as I wrap up here on the latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. And as I've done before, I decided, you know, I'm lonely today. The Mets are starting to play better, but I was a little lonely today. So I brought in an old friend to take some mailbag questions with me. Now, the last time I did this, people got mad at me because they said, I want to hear from you. I don't want to hear some Joe Rando and their opinion. But here's what I promise. I'll give you my opinion on all mailbag questions, but I'm also going to want to know what my next guest or contributor, or whatever you want to call it. My buddy Steve Keen used to host a podcast with me many moons ago, one of the OG Mets bloggers back in the day. And he is retired and he's coming out of retirement just to hang out. He kind of parachutes in like Mike Francesa does on his Riverbets podcast. And it's Steve Keen, formerly of the Grainpole Society, parachuting in on the Talking Mets podcast, looking to give a couple of comments. Steve, thanks for joining me on this Sunday, and I was lonely, so I called you. I figured the retiree would pick up the phone and hang out with me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I'm like Francesa. You know, I'm on first-name basis with all my doctors, you know. I'm with Jim Dolan. I'll be sitting courtside at Nick's Spurs, you know.
I would like to see that. I do remember back in the days being that we are having a little 90s nostalgia with the Knicks making the NBA Finals against the Spurs. I always remember because I had a partial season ticket plan. I used to remember watching, going to usually one or two games a series, and I'd see Francesa. He used to have the brown jacket, if you remember, Steve. Remember the brown jacket he used to wear?
That leather jacket. That,
yeah. And he would, and you could pick him out because you saw it new. He would tell everybody during the show he would be sitting, and he would sit with the media. They wouldn't be cheering, of course, but I could pick up. I mean, even in the 300 section, I could see Francesa with the brown jacket even back then. So, how you doing, man? Are you ready to talk some Mets baseball here?
Francesa was always in the building, you know that.
Well, it's funny. I use that when I tweet on and I put on Facebook. I'm in the building. I don't know if how many people get that when I put. That's an old school thing. So we'll start out with this. You know, I had Andrew Muscato on earlier, Bobby's partner in the media company, and he had a chance as a young man, as a young student, about 20 years ago, to follow Bobby around in Japan, and he really gave us a nice perspective of Bobby V and who he really was, truly an innovator, truly a pioneer, especially with the Japanese coming into the States and having acceptance of Japanese baseball. But in an era where, and I said this in the open, where managers are always criticized for being just an extension of the front office, Bobby's a dying breed. Bobby was truly, and I mean this, and Steve, tell me if you disagree, I put him as a change agent in terms of how he changed the New York sports franchise on the field, because these others also changed it off the field, with Parcells, with Riley, Davey Johnson, Joe Torre. I put him right up there with those coaching luminaries.
Oh, yeah. You know, no question about that. You know, remember, he took over for Dallas Green. And it was near the end of the season. There was maybe about 2 weeks left in the season when he took over. And the whole time he just stood in the dugout and just observed. And he was able to figure out who I'm keeping and who I got to get rid of. Because, you know, a new manager comes in. If you really want to be with the team, you're going to show you want to be with the team. And other guys will be like, well, you know, I want to be on out of here. And they were out of there. He changed the whole culture. Because coming in, you know, his attitude, the way he managed, and then, of course, we adding the players that we added back then. And we went from a team that was, you know, with Dallas Green. Dallas Green was kind of like a John Tortorella. He's good for a couple of years, then he wears on you.
Wrong place, wrong time. I had Ryan Thompson on the show. I had Ryan Thompson on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, boy.
And Ryan actually liked Dallas a lot, but wrong place, wrong time with that young team.
Yeah. But when Valentine took over, you know, he led us to the playoffs in 99 and then to the World Series. We won a pennant in 2000. And of course, what happened at 9/11, how he took over, the leadership that he took over, and his players just followed his lead down there. And the Mets were one of, if not the leading sports team in the city that really did a lot of work there at 9/11. Not just, you know, with the firemen and the pile and stuff, but Also, he kept in touch with a lot of kids of the firemen, first responders who passed, to make sure that these kids had everything they needed. He got them scholarships to college and stuff like that. So his mark, not only in baseball, not only with the Mets, but his mark on the city of New York is indelible.
And what I laugh about, and I say this all the time, and the fans who listen to this show have heard it so many times, they probably could recite it. A manager's success to me is managing up, especially with the front office, managing the clubhouse, managing the bullpen. That's the only X's and O's I really worry about, and managing the media. And the media, I was looking at their tweets, the beat reporters this past Saturday when Bobby was holding his press conference, were smitten with him, which tells you how far we've come. Because I got to tell you, I lived through it. The beat reporters that covered Bobby in 19 from 1997 to 2002, they were far from smitten with Bobby, far from smitten. But we've come so far to the other side. And this is not a knock on Carlos Mendoza, who doesn't have much of a personality. He gives you as straight as he can within the confines of what a front office wants revealed. But the fact that they had an individual on the dais answering questions honestly, having a back and forth dialogue, smiling, laughing. Now, it's easy when you're not managing the ball club, but that was Bobby. That was Bobby as a manager. And I think the fans, the younger fans, don't realize, because I've seen some of them write, well, why is Bobby in the Hall of Fame? He took a team that had some good players and a lot of component and what we call trash or treasure types, even at some point, and he turned them into a perennial contender up until 2002 when things went a little sideways late in that year. And I could tell you the media did not love Bobby. And it was tough because Torrey across town and the Yankees. But they didn't love Bobby, so it's amazing how far he's come.
Well, you know, if you ever, I've met Bobby Valentine a couple of times.
So have
When you
I.
talk to him, he's a highly intelligent guy.
And
This
he's
guy,
intimidating. He's the one of the few that have intimidated me in person in the business. And I don't mean I've met a lot of people, but one of the few sports individuals that I've actually had a little, I was a little intimidated sitting down next to him. It was a long time ago, but I felt a little intimidated.
because it's, you know, he wants, you know, he's the type of guy that wants to know if you know what you're talking about. If you know what you're talking about and you know your stuff, then he'll have conversation with you. He's like one of these guys who doesn't have time for fools, you know. And I spoke to him a couple of times. I met him once at he had like a whole seminar at the Hard Rock Cafe in Manhattan. And I was and I he knew about the Crane Pool Society. And he even had me do some stuff with him. He was doing YouTube stuff at the time. I don't think he does. He it was only like a short time. I think his son was involved in it. But highly intelligent guy, a personality that's like off the charts. And you know he and to you know talking to Valentine and like I said, he feels people out. If you're not, you know, if you're not somebody who knows what's what, you know, he's going to just keep moving on from you. But he was highly intelligent, and you could tell that he's a motivator. And that was a big thing too.
Absolutely. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, because I only saw him at the end of his career. And when I had heard, and I had known a couple of years ago, they were thinking about putting Lee Mazzilli in the Mets Hall of Fame. I think Jay Horowitz had a lot to do with that. I think Jay also was pushing hard for Gary Carter with the number retirement. And when I first heard it, I was like, I think that's a road too far. Look, it's the Mets Hall of Fame. Okay. It's a Hall of Fame inductee, but you also want to have that Hall of Fame to be prestigious to a certain degree. But if you look at Lee's stats when he came up, when he was in the Saturday Night Fever part of the, Mets world, 1977 till when he got dealt to Texas in 1982, he was a really good center fielder. Top 20 center fielder, maybe towards the back half of all the center fielders in the sport, a guy who got on base at a high rate, played good defense. I know he was playing for a bad team in one of the worst eras in Mets history, but he had pop. He could steal bases. If he was on the Yankees or he was on a contending team, this is a top of the order igniter. And a lot of people forget, Steve, a couple of big hits in the World Series to get rallies started. Great pinch hitter in the mold of Rusty Staub and some other great pinch hitters the Mets have had throughout their history. And I think a little bit of a player that once you start to peel the onion a little bit, maybe didn't have the career that the hype was out there for, but he was a really good Met and a Met in two different phases of his career.
He was a terrific all-around player as a young guy. I mean, he stole bases. He was a good, really good stolen base guy. He played an excellent center field. He had some pop in his bat. And and think of it this way. He gets drafted in 73. 73 is a pivotal year in Met history. They got to the World Series, but this is also when Gil Hodges passed away, which to me is the worst thing in Met history. You can go back to Gil Hodges dying to when the downfall of the organization. Now in 3 years he comes up. He's what, 21 when he comes up, and they put a whole campaign on him. They put his picture in the papers. They had his the pic. It was all over the subway, and it was like, the magic is back. Take your kids to see our kids. They really put everything on him. And look, he was a really good looking young guy. He wore the tight pants that Bobby Valentine pointed out at the ceremony, and he was the matinee idol. He really was, and he was the marketing tool that the Mets had, and he did he played he was very he was a really terrific Met. Now, the younger fans don't know it because they don't like history. And when they have these Hall of Fame events, they have these old timers days. I'm especially now, like when they're going to have the 40th anniversary of the '86 Mets. You have to be a certain age to really not only understand it, but to appreciate that era. And a lot of these young guys say, we see it on social media. They have no clue of what this organization was back then. He went from being, when he came up, Joan Payson had passed away. Her husband, Charles Payton, he didn't want anything to do with the team. Donald Grant got his grip on this team and destroyed it because the daughter, Linda DeLeray, took over. She had no idea what she was doing. And Grant held on as long as he could before they could sell it. And then once they did sell it, and the Doubleday Wilpon people, they took over, everything changed. And that's when Mazzilli gets traded to Texas. And the deal it turns out it was one of the best deals in the history of the
They got
organization.
Darling. They got Darling and Terrell, which turned to Darling and Howard Johnson.
And then in '86 he comes back, and he's a major player in the World Series. Without him and Sid Fernandez are the forgotten players of that World Series. Those two guys helped the Mets win a World Championship. The players know it. If you ask Hernandez, you ask Darling, you ask any of those guys, they'll tell you. Sid Fernandez coming out of the bullpen when he did, and Lee Mazzilli as a pinch hitter coming through in key situations was one of the key parts of them winning a World Series.
Absolutely. And now they are in the Mets Hall of Fame. And I don't want to belabor it because it was a conversation for last week, but I had put out there that I think that although Gary Carter clearly had his best seasons by far with the Expos, and I now as an older, more mature, more versed baseball aficionado, I understand why he went into the Hall of Fame as a Montreal Expo. Didn't understand it 25 years ago when it happened as a Mets fan. But, I think the only way to put the cap now, I really think they should put the cap on 86 after this 40th anniversary. I think it's time to put it away. I think it does more harm than good going
I
forward.
agree.
But I think number 8 could be the cherry on top of the 86 sundae. I know it's not going to happen this year. I don't know if it'll happen. I heard that there's a lot of hesitation, starting with Cohen, to make it happen. Anthony DiComo wrote a little bit about it, and I've heard a lot of the same things. Any thoughts on that? I just want to put a little bow on the whole 86 thing here.
I agree with you 100%. Let's have this 40th anniversary and let's put it away for 10 years until the 50th. I don't,
Maybe ne
but
maybe never again. Maybe you got to wait. Maybe it's time to put it away for good. That's what I think.
The problem you have is that, we have two championships to hang our hat on, 1969, 1986. Most of those 1969 guys are either have passed on, or they're well in their 80s and close to 90, so you're not going to be trotting them out to Citi Field.
Right,
But
right.
the Carter thing, remember, his number was taken out of circulation. This is the same thing they did with Willie Mays's 24. It wasn't retired, but it was taken out of circulation. The only time Willie Mays's 24 came back out was when Rickey Henderson joined the Mets, And
Oh, remember
Ricky
Kelvin
asked,
Torve had it really briefly. Remember Kelvin Torve? And everybody had a fit out of it, you know?
But Ricky went to Willie Mays and asked him if he could wear the
Sure.
24, and Mays says, yes, you can wear it. And he
Right.
was the one that, but then they put it back into, now some equipment guy made a mistake. They were on the road. They had to give the kid a number to play. They made a mistake. You would think, like, you know, it was a capital crime. Okay, they rectified the mistake. They gave the kid 55, and that was fine. But
Right.
Morabito, Nick Morabito, who they gave to 55. Now, would I be upset if they retired number eight? No. But if you're going to retire number eight, you have to include Yogi Berra. You have to include Yogi Berra with the number eight. Now, people be saying, what are you talking about? Okay. Back in 1962, 63, 64, Berra was a coach for the Mets. He was the first base coach. He came over. Casey Stengel wanted him there. He even was a player coach for the Mets back then. Then Yogi was a manager of the Mets, took the Mets to the World Series in 1973. And Yogi is one of the most underappreciated players in all of baseball, because if you look at his record, how many championship teams he was on, and the player that Yogi was. People can't see past the Yogiisms to look at Yogi the player, right? Now, Yogi, when I was a kid, I always thought Yogi was a Met. But of course, the Yankees was where he made his career. But
Sure.
if you're going to, the same thing how the Yankees do with number 10, with Bill Dickey and Phil Rizzuto. You can put the eight up there, have a ceremony, but you need to include the Berra family when you do it, and mention how this is for Gary Carter and Yogi Berra. But
That's
you know, if
fair.
they retire
Interesting.
it, they retire it.
Yep,
The thing is,
that's fair. That's fair.
the Mets have not retired numbers during the Wilpon era. I don't think they didn't want to pay for the ceremonies. Now, Cohen takes over, and he wants to bring back the organization. And he does a great, they do a great, him and his wife do an outstanding job of this. And Jay Horowitz. They bring back old time. If you played for the Mets, you come to Citi Field, you're going to be treated like a king. Your whole family's going to
Right.
be taken care of.
Yep.
And I'll be saying, you know what? Jerry Kuzman, if you're a Mets fan of my age, you know Jerry Kuzman was an outstanding pitcher and an outstanding Met. And again, in 1969, he was the key guy in 1969 getting to winning that World Series. His number is retired. David Wright, you had to, you know, that's a no-brainer, because he's one of the great Mets. And the fact that they've been able to bring Daryl Strawberry back and Dwight Gooden and bring them back in, make them ambassadors, I think that's a great thing. But now it's like, okay, let's not cheapen the number retirement. Let's not be like the Yankees and put, you know, Paul O'Neill's plaque out there and not do Greg Nettles. And because Greg Nettles should have a plaque out there too. I mean, he was a great Yankee, a great third baseman, one of the best. Don't
That
cheapen, because when you start doing too many, then it kind of loses it. But the one thing they should do, they have Bob Murphy up there and they have Ralph Kiner. They have to put Lindsey Nelson up there.
that's fair. That's fair too. And I
Yeah,
think a
they
lot of
have
younger
to.
fans, I think if you're gonna do the history thing, you gotta do it right. You gotta make up for the lost time. I will say I agree with you. I get emails, and I'm sure I'll get them this week. You know, fans who's like, why do you care about these players from the 90s and from the 80s and from the 70s? I want to talk about the team. And when the team is in the thick of things and playing well, maybe that's more prevalent. I think that I've kind of backed off some of the history segments because I know that from a radio standpoint, they don't resonate as much. Plus, there's oversaturation now with the amount of podcasts and radio that are out there. The mainstream is figured stuff out that when I started this thing 20 years ago, they weren't doing. But I agree with you on that. Now, I've been hard on the fans, and we'll get to some of the mailbag. So the mailbag, Steve, is tweets, emails, chat room. I try to get it to everybody, but I also try not to do redundancy, and I try to, get a smorgasbord of topics. So to start out, I've been tough on the fans. I see fans going on social media. The one that drove me nuts the other day is he has a shirt, "I hate my team," and he goes to Citi Field and he's on there telling how much he hates the team. Another dope, this has nothing to do with the Mets, sold his Knicks fandom to become a Lakers fan. It's one
Yeah,
stupid fan. There's one
I
stupid fan, and I think we're in an era where fans like to, sell on social media pain and misery. It's almost the Joe Benigno factor over there. It's not healthy when your outlet in your hobby is constant negativity. Nobody's happy. I'm not happy about where the team is at, but I'm also trying to take a very top line, fair and balanced view of where this organization is going. Now, I got an email from Robert, and no, well, tweet from Robert a few days ago, and Robert said this. Now, I've only been to one game at Citi Field this year, and it was that rainy, cold night a few weeks ago when they got blown out by the Nats. So that's not a good representation of probably what the environment at Citi Field has been or will be the rest of the year. But he writes, "You should get away from this site," meaning Twitter. "I was at the game last night. This is, I believe, the game the last game of the series against Cincinnati. People having a great time. You would never have known how terrible this year has been. Huge Let's Go Mets chant in the ninth. Brought a friend who hasn't been to a game in years and was amazed at how fun the scene was." So Robert is telling me, basically, hey, you're wrong, Mike. Social media is not the real world. I'm hoping that he's right and I'm wrong. You have any perspective on that? Because I'm very worried about the negativity seeping in from this fan base, and it's really going to have a culture shift that I think could be negative in the long run.
I agree 1,000% with Robert. I've been to six games this year. The Mets fan who goes to Citi Field is the complete opposite of the so-called Mets fan on social media, especially on Twitter or X, whatever they want to call it. The people who are there in the stands love the Mets, rooting for the Mets, understand that it's been a really rough season, but they want it to turn around. They want their players to play better. They support their players and they support the organization. Now, I've been to Citi Field last year before, and I've been in the team store where Alex Cohn has been in there asking people, have you found what you're looking for? What are you looking for, something special? She's the owner. She don't need to be there, but she's there. She cares. Steve, you know, the social media Mets fan has it in their head about the casino and Metropolitan Park, thinking that that's all Steve Cohen wanted. Steve Cohen's a 70-year-old man who once bought a team that these people, if they ever dealt like how you and I have dealt with the Wilpons, that's why I laugh at these people. You don't know what you're talking about.
He,
This
by the way,
guy
he
is.
didn't. He could have done a lot better use of that money if he wanted it as an investment than a baseball team. Be
Sure.
honest with you.
Sure, he could have.
He even said that, and he's right. A baseball team in and of itself is not a great investment until you sell it. It's a great investment when
Right.
you sell it, which it's like property. Sometimes you have to wait years and years and years to sell it.
But he bought it because his father-in-law is a diehard Mets fan. If you ever seen Alex Cohen's father at the games, the guy is a diehard Mets fan, and he's brought an atmosphere to Citi Field. Now, we remember when they first opened Citi Field, the first time we all went there, and we were like, there's like no Mets gear here. If you remember how I got into an argument with, what was it, David Newman, over
David Newman.
they had Brooklyn Dodger merchandise in the team store. I mean, it's incredible. Look, the younger Mets fan is just like this younger Knicks fan. If the Knicks don't win the finals, these people are going to go absolutely nuts. They're going to be yelling at everybody. Okay. But if they do win, New York City is going to be on fire for about a week. It's going to be crazy.
I agree. I agree with that. I'll tell you what I think, what struck me. I don't know if you've read it, but Hayden Senger had a bottle of Dom Perignon waiting for him in his locker after his first big league home run. Hayden Senger,
Yeah.
when Alvarez comes back, maybe as early as next week, is going to be back in the minors. Maybe we never hear from him again. I don't know how many owners would do that. And I know, oh, well, he's rich. It's a pocket change for him. It's the thought that sometimes that impresses me. And players see that. When a player is in that clubhouse and they see Hayden Senger, who may never get another big league at bat when Alvarez comes back, get that kind of treatment on a day where Christian Scott got his first win, that sticks. And I think that that's a big deal. And I understand everybody's frustrated and everybody calls me. Which is funny because I never used to be called this a team fanboy. I'm trying to get a job with Stearns. It's the usual nonsense that goes on social media. I don't need a job, from anybody in the Mets organization or anybody in radio. I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. I do this because I love this, and sure, there's a few bucks in it. I just think that perspective-wise, winning is not a straight line, and I think the money and the access to resources has clouded the Mets fans' thought process, where they just said, "Well, we're going to be the Yankees and the Dodgers overnight." And I don't think they realize you had 60 years of baggage that had to be cleaned up. That's not going to be cleaned up overnight. I mean, I think that's the problem. And I think that Robert, and thank you again, Robert, for the tweet. I hope he's right. I hope the environment at the ballpark is more positive than what I see on X. And yeah, if the team is not hustling, I get it. And the players are unlikable. I see a lot of the worst team money can buy references. That is a terrible reference. The worst team money
That's
can
awful.
buy is more about players. And Ryan Thompson talked about it. That's why I had Ryan Thompson on. I was hoping the fans could listen to him and hear what he had to say. These were players that were collecting paychecks, didn't want to be there, were not the most likable guys to begin with. It was as much about off the field than it was about the play on the field. Because in essence, they were, when you look at the stats, a 75 to 77 win team. That's not horrible when you talk about now the top payroll in baseball, sure. But a 77 win team is not, well, like the next year, they lost 106 games. It bottomed out because they just had a bad mix of personalities and players that were just looking to collect a working retirement check. Let's just put it that way. And I think there's no connection here. I think this is an organization that has some bones. They have to figure out this transition from the Alonso era to the next era. And I think this is the pain with that, to tell you the truth.
The way I look at the season, obviously, no one in that organization thought this was going to be. But when you bring in guys from other organizations, and you bring, I mean, it takes them a while to get. It took Juan Soto a while to just go from the Bronx to Queens. It's different. You're in a new clubhouse. Say like you're Bo Bichette. You've been with Toronto. You know everybody in the organization. You've come up through the organization. You know every guy in that clubhouse. Now you come to New York. You come to the Mets. I don't know a lot of these guys. Maybe I know them from maybe, seeing on the field, how you doing. I don't know Carlos Mendoza. I don't know David Stern. I don't know how this organ. I don't know. I have Francisco Lindor, who's a big personality in this clubhouse. I don't know if I should, voice my opinion on anything. And it takes a while. Now, here's what Juan Soto said today, which I guess it went over everybody's head when talking about AJ Ewing and Carson Bench. When he was asked, "Are you a mentor to them?" He goes, "Oh, I'm not a mentor. They're the same as me. If they can speak up and say what they need to say, just like I can, they're with me. They're the same as me." And now that's a guy who, let's face it, Soto's one of the top two, three baseball players in the world, telling
Right.
the two rookies, "Hey, you don't look to come to me like in awe. No, you're just like me. And if you got something to say, you say it. If you want to do something, you go and say it. If you have something on your mind, bring it out." Now, he doesn't want to be a mentor, but he just showed leadership
Yeah.
by coming out with that. So now, you're telling these young guys, and you could see how these young guys, when they come up, they're embraced by the veterans, and that's a big thing. That was not the case back then with you had Vince Coleman and Brent Saberhagen and Bobby
Not at all.
Bonilla.
Nope.
Oh, and I'll go even further. Al Leiter and John Franco were the same way, the way they treated Scott Kazmir.
There was a
When
different era of inclusion with young players. And yeah, John Franco and Al Leiter had as much to do with pushing Kazmir out than
Oh yeah,
anybody. But shame on the front
they
office
ran.
for allowing it to happen.
Well, shame on Jeff Wilpon, because Jeff Wilpon, as long as you played golf with Jeff Wilpon and you were buddy with Jeff Wilpon and you laughed at his stupid jokes, you were set. And Leiter and Franco had street smarts and they knew they could play. Because let's face it, you and I've both met Jeff Wilpon and he's a patsy, so they took advantage of him, and that's how they got what they wanted, It's not like that now. It's not like that anymore. It's all changed.
I
It's
think
changed
that's
for
what
the
drives.
better.
I think the fans were used to driving a lot of public opinion that led to Mets making moves because of WFAN, fan outrage, Joe Benigno, Francesen Russo. And I'll tell you what, this guy Stearns, he don't care. He doesn't care what I
Exactly.
say, what you say, what the
Exactly.
fans say. And I understand what the fans are saying on this whole thing. Hey, I pay the bills. You have every right not to show up. I think it's an utter
Don't
waste of
go.
time if you show up to just boo and be angry. I think it's a waste of time to go on social media and tell everybody how bad Stearns is and how much you hate this team. The best panacea, the best tonic to get what you want is apathy. And I have a feeling you see Ewing and even Howie Rose, I was listening to the game on the radio today, talked about it, reminds him a little bit of Lenny Dykstra. Benj quietly was among the leaders in batting average in May, only 308, but in this day and age, that's pretty good in this
Yes.
current era. I think, and I really opened because I think the key to this whole season, whatever the final record is the three young, possibly five young starters in McLain, Scott, Tong, and then maybe Wenninger, Thornton, and maybe Santucci. I think how many of those guys can become permanent parts of the rotation and how many of those guys can be high level is key. This is not hopeless. 93 did not feel hopeful because there was Bobby Jones and Jeremy Burnett and Ryan Thompson and Jeff Kent, which were nice players, but there wasn't this pipeline other than Generation K, which kind of popped up the year after. And they came and they went really quick. There wasn't a pipeline back then of a farm system. The Mets haven't had a top five farm system and haven't really had a commitment to a farm system probably since Frank Cashin was around. And that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And guess what, guys? If we were in the era of social media, Frank Cashin took 4 years. Totally different situation. I get it. I understand the payroll. I'm not happy with, and I'm not trying to rationalize because this is a failure. Not being able to bridge in a six wild in a three wild card era, a playoff team, while you're trying to figure out the young players is unacceptable. I understand that, but it doesn't mean it's hopeless. Totally different situation, and this guy Stearns doesn't care, and Cohen. He'll worry about the fan experience at the ballpark, but you're not going to tell him who's going to be playing shortstop. I can tell you that.
I fight with these Yahoos all the time on there. I said, do you understand no matter what you say about Davis, he does not care what you
He's
think.
getting, he's
He
got, he's
doesn't.
not leaving a day before his contract is up.
No,
That's
and
my
he's probably going
prediction.
to get an extension because people don't understand. They don't look at the whole organization, okay? In St. Lucie, at Clover Park, their main facility. They're investing tens of millions of dollars to extend it, to add more things to it. The Mets have the most recent up-to-date technology for hitting and pitching than any team in baseball. They're making a real big investment in Latin America. Their Dominican Republic air the thing their facility there upgraded. They have upgrades in Venezuela. The Dodgers have like kind of got the hold on the Asian market. The Mets are doing it in the Latin American market, and it's going to pay off. Well, young guy Elia Pena now playing in St. Lucie. He'll probably be up here in Brooklyn in maybe about a month or two, maybe around July. When that kid comes up here, then the eyeballs are going to see hit this kid play, and he's destined to be on this team maybe within 2 years. And that's when we're going to see where he's going to play. But he's a talent. He's an unbelievable talent. There's pitching. They work on pitchers. They work so hard with their pitching. You can see that the kids that they bring up, if people don't understand, there's a huge difference when you're pitching to AAA hitters. You've come up to the major leagues. These are the best of the best. And we're seeing it with McLain. They start to figure you out. And when they start to figure you out, you got to go to plan B, and you got to figure out how do I get back to where I was fooling these guys. But the commitment that's made to this organization, it's never been like this, never.
No,
And and
no.
it's going to pay off. See, the biggest mistake that Steve Cohen made was when he said, I want to win a World Series like within 4 years. He should never have said that because it is so hard to get to a World Series. People forget the Dodgers. The Dodgers haven't been like this for 20 years. When Frank McCourt owned the Dodgers, he was taking all the profits, putting it in his pocket. And that's why they tossed him out of baseball. This is what the Dodgers are doing is recent. And
Right.
even the Dodgers even will say that they don't want to sustain this kind of a payroll. They're building their farm system. You cannot sustain on free agents. These people, they make me laugh. Oh, cut this guy, cut that guy. You know how many people the Mets have released that are making 2 million, 3 million, 1 million, even if they're making minimum? That adds up. That all adds up. What other team can absorb that? It used to be the Yankees who could do that when George Steinbrenner was running it. He'll eat a contract. He didn't care. He wanted to win. And this is what Steve Cohen's doing. He's eating contract. We had 48 pitchers last year on the staff due to injury. All those guys were getting paid. And not only getting paid, their medical, their housing, everything was taken care of. And then when you release them, you're losing that money. You're losing money on this. And I don't know. I don't think the people on social media that do all the bitching and moaning, they don't go to games. They do not go to Citi Field. They just
Well,
sit home. They watch SNY, or they listen to Howie and Keith Radd and Pat McCarthy. But the thing is, and they listen to WFAN, which one day we'll do one of these. It's going to be about 2 hours on the life and death of
the love and
WFAN.
death of WFN. Well, but you, but what you're saying is, and this is from Josh, and he makes a great point in the chat. He I don't think he doesn't think he should get fired. And he's not certain that he should be fired. And he admits what I've said, the turnover. What people have to understand, Steve, is the turnover is so bad for the organization in general. Like you can't just fire the president of baseball operations without upheaving the whole organization again, which with all the upheaval they've had since Sandy Alderson first got sick in 2018, this could set them back 5 years. But the distinction he's asking for is, do I actually think he's doing a good job? And I'm saying, and I get a lot of times people criticize the big league roster. I think it starts with the farm system. He's wanted since he came in here to incorporate young players. He was left with young players that are lacking. The real story of 2026 is Beatty, Vientos, Alvarez, and Mauricio. And maybe I'll put Mauricio to the side because he's always hurt. They just haven't stepped up and taken the baton from Nimmo, Alonso, McNeil. He wanted to move away from Nimmo, Alonso, McNeil core. He wanted to put his own core in. And I think he thought this year he'd have enough between the free agent acquisitions, Benj and possibly Ewing, and the kids that are left over to do that offensively. And he really has done a decent job with the bullpen and the starting rotation. The Mets' bullpen and starting rotation aren't the reason why they're significantly under 500. So I think he's doing not a good job. I think he's made some moves that haven't worked out. But I think in the situation he came into, which was a team that refused to rebuild, he's been retrofitting as much as you can, taking appropriate risks. And if you look at the Mets on payroll, they're not in a bad payroll spot in 3 years, 4 years, especially considering we don't know what the whole baseball rules will be on payroll.
Right. Yeah, I mean we don't know what the CBA is going to be. We have no idea. I don't even want to speculate on that. Now, you talk about Alonso and Nimmo and McNeil, okay? Steve Cohen had to go. He had to go down to Tampa to meet personally with Alonso to try to get him to sign the deal in 25. And he said it was the worst negotiation he's ever been a part of. Now, this is a man who is in the finance world, who's a venture capitalist, who deals with vultures on Wall Street, and he's telling you that the Pete Alonso negotiation was the most excruciating negotiation he's ever had. That tells you right there what these Alonso simp nuts. They're like a cult. Alonso did not want to be here anymore. Alonso did not care about being a Met. He doesn't care about winning. The only thing he wants to win is the home run derby. That's what he wants. He wanted more years and he wanted money. And they said, "Look, we're not giving you 5 years. There's no way." And how could he be paid more? And he was paid the highest AAV of any first baseman in baseball. And he's not Freddie Freeman, okay? And he got paid more than Freddie Freeman. He wanted to be paid, and he wanted 5 years. And Stearns, rightly so, they said, "Look, we're not doing it. We can't. You can." You, and then as soon as last year, last game of the year, they lose. We're out of the playoffs. It's devastating to fans, players, organization. Not to Pete. First thing he said was, "Well, I'll be opting out of this contract." So where does he go? Goes to Baltimore. Baltimore, their owner, I forget the T. Rowe Price guy. He's I forget his name now. Rubenstein, David Rubenstein.
Yep,
He's
Dave
desperate
Rubenstein.
because he can't fill Camden Yards. People are not coming there. He has to go to a gimmick of squirting water into the stands. But he's not getting anybody there. He caves in and gives the contract to Alonso. If there was a team in Alaska that would pay him 5 years, $130 million, Pete was going. He didn't care. So now he's an Oriole. Good.
Well,
Goodbye.
I
You're an
think
Oriole.
what, and I know we're talking about something that has been beat to death, but I think what Stern saw at age 30, Alonso had maybe arguably his second best season of his career next to his rookie year. I think his best season was 22 when he drove in 131 runs. He looks at 24. If you take away the Devin Williams home run in the postseason, and he was pretty good against the Phillies and the Dodgers, he wasn't that great. He's having a similar type of time in Baltimore. He's 31. He sees a declining player. Now, I think what, Steve, when I tie this in, both Tim and Lewis in the chat room, and a lot of what the chat room wanted, what us was us was me to talk about Stearns because I've been defending him. They're talking about bringing in a GM. I have no problem with them bringing in a GM, but my point I made on the show, and I actually made this on Anthony Rivera's show, Subway to Shea, and I didn't probably make it on this show. We don't really know how the Mets front office works because Stearns is the one that talks. You never hear anything from assistant GM Edward Brizuela. Do you know anything about Jonathan Strangio, who has been in the organization? I forgot his name until I looked it up last week. You have Ben Zosmer, who's their analytics guy. Andy Green, former big leaguer. He's baseball development. You got Beltran in the front office. You got JD Martinez in the front office. We know Chris Gross has a great resume from Houston, amateur international scouting. We don't know anything about these baseball people other than Stearns. So just because he doesn't have a GM in title, he actually has two assistant general managers who are probably making some of the moves. Now, you could say maybe those are the guys that need to go and bring somebody else in. That's fair. That's fair. But we're treating Stearns like he's a GM. He's a president of baseball operations who has people working on them. And we don't even know the impact of Beltran as well. So we're blaming, and it's his fault he runs the organization, but we're thinking that he's making every decision in a vacuum. He is not, I assure everybody.
There are no leaks coming out of this organization. This
No.
organization is, is tight. You don't get to know anything until it happens. And I think you hit it on the head. He doesn't just sit by himself making decisions. He has people around him. He has, player development people. He has scouting people. He has analytics people. Everybody from each department, they all are involved in what goes on. Now, he sees what's going on now, and it's like this was not what he envisioned. This is what no one in the organization envisioned. Okay, I look at it like he felt he was using this as kind of a bridge year. Let me bring in some veteran guys, solid players. Let's see what we could do. We have young pitchers coming in. And he sees the landscape of baseball. Look at it. The American League is a mess. It's the Yankees, the Rays, and I think that's the and the only teams that are over 500 in the American League. And he sees that you can make the play, or you can make a wild card playoff with 82, 83 wins. It's not impossible.
No, I
So
don't
he
think it's
thinks
going to
I can.
happen in the National League, but you're right. The
Yeah,
bar, the
but
parity has lowered the bar as
yeah.
last year, the bar has been lowered, which makes this even worse that they could be knocked out a couple of years in a row. Let's
Right,
put it that way.
but he sees that landscape, and he's like, I can by next year, AJ Ewing, Benj, they're going to be right there. My pitchers, Tong, Pinero, these, McLain, I'm going to have a real solid staff of young pitchers, and I'm hoping that Alvarez or Beatty or Vientos can really start to do something. Now, he inherited Vientos, Beatty, Alvarez. He has no problem if he doesn't feel off the or if his baseball people they sit and say, listen, we've done everything we can with these guys. Maybe it's time to move along. He has no problem doing that. He has no personal
They've
relationship.
already. I know Vientos will could be easily traded. They dangled him out there, I believe, for Robert Jr., or he was part of the talks last rumored anyway, when they were talking to Chicago last year. I think Vientos for sure. Beatty and Alvarez, I'm not so sure, but I think we're at a. I think we're at fourth and long with both of them, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I won't give up. I won't give up on Alvarez. I would not give up on Alvarez. If you told me you're going to move off from Beatty and Vientos, I could see that. But I'm not ready to move off from Alvarez. He's young. The injuries is what gets you. I mean, he's injured every year, and they have to get through to him about that swing. His swing is so long. If he could just shorten it up a little bit, make
I thought Eric
contact.
Chavez was the reason why his swing was long.
Yeah, well, that's what he thought too. But it's if they could just do that and get and he you can't give up on him yet. He's too young, and he's a catcher, and he's good behind the plate. But the other two guys, it's like after you're going to say like, why are we are they holding anybody up? Is there anybody that's in the organization who we can put at first base that's holding them up? And if not, then all right, you're going to keep them. You can platoon them. I mean, Beatty has played better as a third baseman. I think that's his.
Still doesn't have the power that you would like out of a third baseman.
Well, yeah, he doesn't. And Vientos has power, but my God, is he slow?
And I think
Is
he's a good hitter on a bad team, or a hitter that you could live with in a part-timer-ish role lower in the lineup. Neither one of those guys should be middle of the order hitters. They just aren't at that point.
No.
And I think that's really the issue right now. They're
And the problem is, though,
middle of the order hitters.
with the injuries and stuff, that's what you're stuck with. You have to,
Yeah.
somebody's got to bat fourth, man.
Well,
It just
on
needs.
that, a couple of the fans, Rob over at Spotify, brought up about the philosophy of Jeff Albert, which our good friend Ernie Dove has talked about. Everybody's clamoring for Ernie to come back on and talk about the organization philosophy. I know that others have brought up Albert, and I actually did a quick short for the premium members about, hey, when you look at the Mets minor leaguers outside of Ilian Pena, Mitch Voit, Ryan Clifford, Chris Suero, all the top positional prospects, power, low batting average, not performing well. The organization has long had a philosophy of hitting the ball hard and with launch. What's funny is both Ewing and Bench are not playing to that. They're playing very old school without power. And Jeff Albert is the guy that runs the entire organization's hitting philosophy. You could blame Trey Snicker. I've heard the fans start to say it's time to fire Trey Snicker. I mean, as if
Yeah, they
bringing
want to
in,
fire everybody.
reincarnate Ted Williams. It doesn't matter. If Vientos can't hit, Vientos can't hit. Albert might be part of the problem. I mean, maybe the philosophy is part of the problem.
That's the thing with these hitting coaches. It's like guys have hit since they're 6 years old, and then what got them to where they are is the way they've hit. Now, if you're going to have somebody come in and kind of change like what you're doing, it's kind of hard to do. I mean, to me, when Chili Davis was, when any time if a pitchers aren't pitching well, hitters aren't hitting, it's always let's fire the coaches. Now, I remember when Chili Davis was the hitting coach for the Mets. Chili Davis was an excellent baseball player. He was a hitter. Some of these guys that, sometimes you bring in these coaches that, they're analytically knowing what they're doing. But if they never really played at a high level, it's kind of hard to, for them to really tell a guy what he's doing right and wrong. But I mean, everybody's looking, you can't just start firing people. It doesn't work that way. Especially this whole staff that's come in. It's their first year here. And it's
Six
like,
weeks
give
in, they
them,
want to fire everybody.
yeah. And These are veteran, mostly veteran players. So they're only going to listen. You know, it's not like these coaches are telling them what to do. They're there. They go over film with them. They look at tapes with them. They go on that iPad, looking at everything with them, and they ask them, "What do you think here? What do you think here?" And they point things out for them. They're not. The hitter has the bat in his hand. He's in charge. And he can only look at film, see where he's making his mistakes. Sometimes it's something simple where he's opening a front shoulder, close a little bit, maybe then you get it. And it's mostly confidence. Once, you know, you don't want to, guys start to lose confidence when you go, you know, when you're in like an 0 for 15, 0 for 17, 0 for 20 slump. You lose the confidence. These guys are more psychologists than anything. They have to keep their attitude up. They have to keep them, you know, saying, you know, keep them going, keep them motivated, and tell them how great they are and how it's going to change, and look and help them with either the analytics or with and watching tape.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we'll wrap up on a couple of questions here, Steve. One, got multiple people concerned going into today's start about Nolan McClain. That's Mitch, you know, was concerned going in. And though he only gave up a run, he wasn't great. His control and command were a little bit off. And then Andy writes that he's kicking himself because he made a bet with a Yankees fan friend that McClain was going to be better than Cam Schlittler. Now, here's my thing about McClain. They clearly are working on things with him because, I mean, his numbers aren't much different overall from a year ago. He's just given up more home runs and he's been pounded in a couple of starts. But I looked at today and I talked about this in the open, and this is where the real development, and maybe Justin Willard will be the most important component of this team's season and the turnaround with the foundation of pitching. Because today, McClain looked, they were, you know, mixing it up between the sinker and the cutter and the sweeper a lot more. I mean, normally, if you look at him this year, he's been throwing mainly, you know, sinkers at a high rate. He wasn't doing that today. Maybe that's why he was all over the place. They were trying to work on things with him. Development, and I know a team that expected with a big payroll shouldn't be in development, but I think each of these pitchers, Scott coming off of TJ surgery, McClain, the second time around the league with people starting to figure him out, Tong, whether he's a starter or reliever, and then we'll see with some of the others. I think this is the story of the season. I think McClain has the moxie, he has the attitude. And I saw on Buster Olney's podcast, they were even suggesting, and I don't know what to think. They're saying, you know, maybe his stuff is too good. Maybe he's too you know, spin rate centric, too analytically inclined, which I don't know how that even comes up. But to me, I think Justin Willard, from what we know, he wants you to throw your best pitch in the zone. And he got a good amount of ground balls. And that's what McClain has been missing this year. His ground ball rate is down. Maybe a 60% ground ball rate was not sustainable, but he was down into the, you know, the low 40s or mid 40s. Getting that ground ball rate back up with the way his spin is, and he could still strike guys out, but maybe more contact, more hitting the ball on the ground is the key, because that's how he got out of the inning today. Some soft contact and getting out of it.
Yeah, and he's got to get the walks. He's got to get control of the walks. He walked five guys today. You can't, you know, walks, errors, you can't be giving teams four, five, six outs in an inning. And when you walk guys, that's what you're doing. Instead of getting them out, you're putting them on, and they're not earning the base. Like you say, he puts so much spin. When you watch the ball, it's like a wiffle ball sometimes the way he
Yep.
throws it.
Right.
And the problem I think he's having now is he lacks the command of these pitches. That last year when he came up, he had the command, but it was still a knock on him when he came up last year about the command and the walks. And I don't know if the WBC has anything to do with it. I mean, you know, he pitch maybe he need maybe if you get you gave him. Like go through the rotation one time, give him an extra day. I don't know, but I mean, but he is a competitor. You can see it. He is a competitor, so it's not like I mean he you can see that he does get upset, mad on the mound when he doesn't come through. And he's even said he goes, I'll trade strikeouts for groundouts any day, because you when you. This is what happens with Peterson too. You start falling behind, and your pitch count just keeps going up. And it's not like the 100-pitch thing that people obsess about. It's each inning. What's a high-stress inning? If you're pitching 25 to 30 pitches in an inning, that's extremely stressful. Now, if you're just getting 15 pitches, 16, 17, then you're going to be able to complete more innings. And we see it with Freddy Peralta. You see it with Peterson, and now you see it now with McClain. It's getting to where don't have those stressful innings. Try to get to a 15 minimum 15 inning pitch count to each inning, and save yourself the aggravation and save yourself the wear and tear, and try to get to that sixth, try to get to the seventh inning. That should be the minimum. Let's try to get to that seventh inning.
And I said this in the open. What I really liked today is that he was looking over at the dugout in the fourth inning when he was walking the ballpark, and Mendoza let him work through it, and he got through five. His pitch count was reasonable at 80. Don't let these guys off the hook. Don't bring Peterson in. You got to learn how to pitch through it. I liked how he tried to mitigate the damage. There was some bad defense behind him in DC. Pitched poorly against Cincinnati. That happens. This is growth. And I think that, and again, I'm repeating what I said in the open. Everybody thinks that every pitcher is going to be Harvey, going to be DeGrom, John Smoltz, Tom Glavine, Randy Johnson, Kevin Brown, who's not even a Hall of Famer, but these are really good pitchers from a bygone era. Not all of them were perfect year one, year two, year three. Randy Johnson didn't really become Randy Johnson until his mid-30s. He was a late bloomer. Even Maddox took a few years. Now, I'm not saying
Took Maddox
McClain
a
is those
while.
guys, but everybody thinks because of Cam Schlittler or Paul Skeens, DeGrom, Harvey, these are Halley's Comets. Doc Gooden, doesn't happen that way. Seaver, we got to get over the whole. You mentioned Al Leiter. Again, let's talk about someone down the totem pole. Al Leiter was a pretty hot shot prospect in the Yankees organization. He did not figure it out until 1996, almost 10 years into his career. And he really busted out when he came to the Mets in 98. He had a really good career in his 30s. Takes guys time. And I know Syndergaard and all those guys, they burst onto the scene, but they also fizzled and had their problems after and never recovered. So maybe this is the opposite. You got to let these guys go through the league a little bit. You can't just give up on them.
And that's the thing, because when McClain comes up last year, he takes the lead, the league by storm. He's great. Now they have data on this guy. They have tape on this guy. Now the hitters are like, all right, he throws this. Now I know. Let me lay off this one. Let me lay off this one. When I see this coming, I know it's going to break away. They know that. Now McClain has to see that and say, okay, now I have to change my approach. And the thing to do today is also, if the guy gets through the lineup twice, it's a success. If you get through the lineup twice and you have the lead, or your team is maybe down a run, you have a quality start. So you're not asking guys to, give you 8 innings of a complete game. You're hoping that they can get through at least the lineup twice without causing too much damage, and then go to your bullpen. And obviously he has the talent. We've seen it too with Tong. Tong came up, he was great. Then he is inconsistent. Even in Syracuse, he'd pitch a game where he's lights out, then the next game he gets lit up. It's going to happen. These guys are young. These guys are only in their early 20s. Some of them, a guy like Tong, could probably still be pitching in college. It's like they're young
And
guys.
Zach Wheeler, think of another guy. Zach Wheeler took a long time to get consistent. I mean, people forget how up and down he was his first few years. And he was forgotten about because of the TJ surgery, but he was one of the more frustrating. He was supposed to be the best of all of them, better than Harvey. He was not great until, unfortunately, right before he left the Mets and then went to Philly and really. So I think they're working on things. I think what I tell the fans is look at Baseball Savant, that's free for everybody. They're working on the pitch mix. Use your eyes. I know Schlittler is going to make it where, Mets fans wanted to have that one-upsmanship. Forget about that. Schlittler has for a variety of reasons. Maybe it's even because he's on a team where maybe they didn't have the expectations. He's already pitched a big game in the postseason. He's ahead of McClain. That doesn't mean he'll be ahead of McClain forever. Now, a couple of things before we go here, Steve. Andy's also tired, and he also wants us to do a wrap up with an NBA Finals prediction. He said he doesn't want me to rush through it. I usually rush through any Knicks talk on here because nobody's tuning in to talk about the Knicks, but I guess we'll make an exception, especially because you're a big basketball guy too, and an ardent Knicks hater, by the way, for the fans. So I have an ardent Knicks hater
Oh
on the
yeah.
show. Hates the Knicks.
Can't
Here's a
stand them.
guy. Can't
Can't
stand
stand
him.
them.
He's a Celtics fan.
Most
He's a Nets
overrated
fan.
sports organization in the world.
There's gonna go. But Andy wrote he's already tired of the CBA negotiations. It feels like the owners of the players are leaking everything just to gain public support. Andy, you're 100% correct. Here's what he says. I wish they would just focus on getting a deal done. Unfortunately, I don't think that'll happen until much up to the 11th hour, and we're going to probably have a lockout in the fall, in the winter. But here's where I'm concerned about the CBA. I thought the players' proposal wasn't bad, but the players' proposal is about an egalitarian system with revenue sharing and the younger players getting a bigger piece of the pie. And no restrictions on the veterans and the one percenters, which is where the problem for the owners is going to be. They don't want to have both sticks, ends of the stick, getting paid. And the owners are basically, and I think there's a bunch of owners that are looking to burn the barn down. They're basically saying, my team valuation is not where I want it to be. If I sold tomorrow, I'm not going to get what I want. For me to continue doing this, I have to go into debt. I don't want to do that. In order to compete with the Dodgers and the Mets and the Yankees and so on and so forth. So they're not going to be happy until there's some cost certainty in the form of a salary cap, which their first proposal was when you add in player benefits and all the other non-40-man roster type of situations, players, a very low cap and a very low, okay floor, but a very low ceiling. I think that's a burn the barn down scenario, and I think that the sport is healthy. I think the sport has got excitement. People still talk about the sport in a way they don't talk about the NBA, even in a way they don't talk about the NFL. And for them to even have a situation where games next year could be lost or talk about losing a season like the NHL did in 2004, I think is dangerous. And in this current day and age, is a death knell with the amount of distractions young people have and people in general. So unfortunately, Andy, I think they're not going to focus on getting a deal done. I think we're setting up the posturing. They're going to do it through the media. You as a fan and you as someone who's working hard for your money is going to hate all of this because these are very wealthy individuals on both sides fighting over a very big pie. The pie is the pie. We all created the pie, so we can't get angry about it. You don't like the pie? Stop spending your money. So unfortunately, I think we're in for a long negotiation, and we may have a similar situation to what we had in 21 into 22, where we're not going to be talking anything but a CBA in the winter.
Yeah, the thing is, when they talk about this cap, it can't be a hard cap. It can't be an NFL hard cap. The only reason that hard cap works in the NFL is because there's no guaranteed contracts. And when the guy signs a $200 million contract, it's like $100 million is a signing bonus up front, and then the rest is spread out. That's not going to happen. They're going to have to have like an NBA type of a cap if they do get one. Where you're going to have bird rights, where you have a player on your team who, when he's up for free agency, you can pay him whatever the maximum. And it doesn't hurt you. I mean, they're looking at right now. This year in baseball is one of the best years they've had in a long, long time. Now, the thing is, with you have all these streaming services out there that they want sports because sports is like the rotisserie chicken at Costco. It's a cost. It gets you in the door. And they'll sell it to you for $3, but while you're there, you're going to be buying other stuff too.
Sure,
This is
sure.
what this is what why Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, they're all getting in bed with the NFL because the NFL is the king of sports and the king of television. And if I can get NFL, now I can sell you that I'm going to have this movie, I'm going to have this special, I'm going to show this documentary, and then you're going to say, well, you know what? Maybe I'll buy the subscription. Maybe I'll get the one where I don't get commercials. I'll get a premium subscription to this network. And that's where the money's going to, the money will be there. The thing is, they have to figure out how do you distribute this money. The Miami Marlins cannot have an $80 million payroll. You while the Dodgers have a $500 million payroll, and the Marlins have an $80 million one. Now you're going to put in a cap, and you're going to say, all right, there's a floor of $170 million. You're telling me the Marlins are going to increase their, how are they going to increase their payroll to $90 million? They can't. Who are they going to sign? Nobody wants to play there. You could have a, if Juan Soto or Aaron Judge were out there as free agents, they
Well,
and
I
they're
mean,
going to, they could.
Miami is a very nice town. A lot of New Yorkers are going down there. And look, remember, they had that spending spree. They almost got Albert Pujols a decade and a half ago. It's
Yeah.
possible if they have the revenues to and if there's revenue sharing on the TV situation, well, there you go. I mean, it's
Well,
there.
that's the thing. This, you know, the way, you know what happened like years ago with the NFL, Wellington Mara and the Bears owners, the Haas family, they saved the NFL because they said, well, we're going to take, because the Giants had their own TV deal with CBS. And they were getting paid, and they didn't care, and they was, you know, had all their signage, everything. But they said it's best for the league if we take the network money and we share it. That's why you could have a Green Bay Packers, you know, that in that circumstance. Now I don't know how these owners think that, you know, the if in Chicago, in Tampa, Tampa is trying to get this new ballpark built. If they don't get the ballpark built, if they don't get the okay from this Hillsborough County in Florida, where what are they going to do? Are they going to move to Nashville? That's the new hot town, or Salt Lake City? You know what's going to happen? There's so many. You know,
All the New
if
Yorkers moving to Nashville, all the Californians moving to Salt Lake City, making those big
yeah,
markets. Who would have thought it, right?
I know. I mean, you look at Salt Lake City. You would, you know, when the Jazz, you think, oh my God! But the owner, that guy Randy Smith, who owns. He owns the Jazz, and he owns now the Utah Mammoth. He took that Delta, was it the Delta Center? I don't know what they call it now. They all have the corporate names, but he redid that whole place because it was not a hockey friendly arena. He took seats out, but then he had seats that are like obstructed view, and he would sell them for like $5, and people would come, and he would put bars back there, and people would hang out. It's like a renaissance down there. Nashville is now also the hot town. That's where everybody's looking to go. You know, they want to move a team to Nashville. Charlotte has a beautiful minor league team, a ballpark for their
Yep.
AAA.
I have a buddy
Maybe
who works
they
there.
could do it. Yeah,
I have a buddy who
maybe
works there.
they get a major league team. Once they build the stadium in Las Vegas and the A's move there, that's going to make them money. That's
I
going to
see.
become
I
a
go to
place to
Vegas
go.
once a year for business and in August, and I see the progress. It's right next to the casinos, it's right next to Mandalay Bay. So that should be interesting. Now, Steve, we would be remiss if I didn't give you. So just to set this up, we'll wrap up here with the mailbag. And I hope you guys enjoyed, tried something different today. And look, I'll put it out there. If anybody ever wants to be part of a future mailbag, you want to come on with me, Mike Slavatt, talkingmetspodcast.com. Send me an email. I'll try to figure out a date that works. You just called in like Steve did. We had earlier in the year, we had some others that did it. And it mixes it up a little bit. Sometimes I get lonely. I don't want to just talk. But Andy wants me to give a real NBA analysis. Now, I'm a fan of the Knicks. I don't get into the analysis and podcasting like the Knicks film school guys and CP the franchise. Those guys they're incredible content creators for the Knicks. You've got it covered with those guys, right?
Right.
The beat writers for the Knicks, that's a shark tank over there, but they don't do a bad job now, especially since some of the since the Isolas of the world aren't in there anymore. Frank is not a
Frankie,
Mike
yeah, he's
Sola.
with the he's a net. He's with the Nets.
He's with the
He's
Nets.
our
Although him and Scalabrine do an incredibly good job on NBA radio.
they
And
do a
I'll be
great. I listen
honest,
to them every day. I listen to them every morning. They're very
Justin
good.
Termini is an
Yeah.
acquaintance of mine, and I texted Justin last week. I said, I love your crash outs after the game. Listen to him on YouTube on Termini Crashes Out. Him and Eddie Johnson are funny and great
They're very
analysis.
good.
And I listen to NBA radio more than MLB radio because that's my fandom. That's my outlet. And anything MLB I can get when I need it and look for it. I need a break. That's just my thing. But here's my analysis of the NBA Finals. I think the Knicks playing the Spurs is a better matchup for them. A couple of reasons. One, the Spurs still are kind of figuring things out, or they're figuring things out quick, and Wembanyama figures things out quick. I think Wembanyama is going to wear down as you get to minutes 33, 34, 35, 36, 37. I think the Knicks can wear him down. I think their 3-point shooting is inconsistent, which concerned me with OKC. They have really good 3-point shooting, and the way the Knicks play defense, they tend to leave shooters open. Strus and some of the Cleveland and Philadelphia shooters didn't make the Knicks pay. Even later in the series, Atlanta, they didn't make them pay, although the Knicks have done better on closeouts. I think the way that the Knicks now have diversified the offense, where it's not just Brunson ISOing, they have different ways of doing things, including how they've had some guys coming off the bench and finding their feet in contributing, makes them dangerous. I think they're a bit of a team of destiny. I know that's not analytically, but when that ball rolled around, everybody says it's the NBA magnet they turned down with Landry Shamet, Steve. They said there's a magnet in the ball. When that ball rolled around and Merrill's ball fell out, I said, you know what? After years of Charles Smith and Reggie Miller and, the Carmelo Anthony 2013 team that you and I talked about when we had our sports media watchdog show, and Porzingis flop out and not getting the number one pick, and all the stuff that's happened since Riley left in a lot of ways. I think it's just there's a bit of a team of destiny. And I think the Knicks are deep. I think Mike Brown is a good coach that's able to adapt and adjust. I think the Spurs are tough. Wemby's really tough. And I think if you're going to get Wemby, you're going to get him on the first one, just like the Rockets got Shaq in Shaq's first bite of the apple in 95. So I know that that's not a high deep dive analysis, Andy, but as a fan, that's what I like. Inconsistent 3-point shooting, Wemby's young and not ready, Knicks team of destiny, diversified offense, forward thinking coach, and a deep bench. And let me tell you, some of the Knicks garbage time players, if they're not brought back, they're going to get some decent roles on other teams. There's some good guys there at the end of the bench that are practice players. So that's my NBA Finals. Knicks in six. Steve, take it away. I know you hate the Knicks, but you got to admit things are looking pretty good right now.
No, they are. This is, I think this is going to become one of the best NBA finals we've seen in a long, long time. Wembanyama is the unicorn, but this guy, he's definitely the best player in the world. And there's a culture in San Antonio that comes from Greg Popovich. It goes down to each guy. You see you see Robinson. You see all these guys that won championships, they're all there, and Popovich is still a major voice in the organization. Now, the thing with the Knicks is I think Mike Brown did an unbelievable job after the Atlanta series. It's not talked about enough how now the offense is running through Cat. Cat is terrific. Cat can do what Wemby does, and he's stronger than Wemby. Problem is Cat too many stupid fouls. He has to watch his fouls. Mitchell Robinson, don't worry about the pinky. He don't need us. He's going to be fine. He's a rebounding machine. This is going to be physical, because if you saw the last series, San Antonio with OKC, they got physical with OKC, and OKC couldn't handle that. That poor Chet was just sitting there doing nothing because he couldn't take the physicality of the
Let me
series.
tell you, he ran and hid last night. I watched the second
Yeah,
half. He
that's
ran and hid.
really,
And it was a
really
little
bad.
Nick on Nick crime last night, with the turning point being Hartenstein getting blocked by Luke Kornet,
Yeah.
which many people don't realize. Nobody likes Phil Jackson. But I'll tell you a couple of things, Phil Jackson. He saw Kornet, and he saw Kornet to be a possible good NBA player when nobody did. And he was the first person, I remember this so vividly. He tried to trade Porzingis for Lauri Markkanen, and everybody had a fit. And Dolan was still, rabbit ears back then, because he felt
Yeah.
Porzingis couldn't stay healthy. And sure enough, he was right. And by the way, Steve, on that note, there are fans actually starting to compare Cohen to Dolan. And I think that that's so off base. Dolan is like, Willy Wonka now. He's like Willy Wonka outside of Madison Square Garden handing out game balls. Like, I look at him and I'm like, you're Willy Wonka now. And
I
people
was
love you.
shocked.
It's like George Steinbrenner, Pardew,
There you
it's
go. That's
amazing.
what I was going to say. He has turned into the George Steinbrenner later years. When George Steinbrenner was suspended from baseball, Yankee fans were cheering. They were happy, and they should have been, because Gene Michael took over and then built the 90s dynasty. All of a sudden, now Dolan brings in Leon Rose. And Leon Rose, this is, I think, David Stearns takes from a page from the Leon Rose book. Stop talking to the media. You don't have to have a press conference. Let them starve. Let them starve for information. Leon Rose doesn't talk to anybody. He just goes about
Yep.
his business building a championship team. That's all you got to do.
And he had
No,
some
the
rough
fan.
times. Look, when he had the Kemba
Oh yeah.
Walker era, that one year they didn't make the playoffs with the Tibbs, he got eviscerated. Now Dolan got hit more, but he got eviscerated firing Tibbs. I didn't really like that. But look, I think it's worked out. Maybe Tibbs had run his course. So give him credit. And he didn't have to listen to us. You know, if he listened to us, Tibbs would still be the coach.
This is Tibbs. I compare Tibbs to Brooke Showalter. He'll get you to the point where you're ready to go, but he's not going to get you over the top. You got to bring in the guy, get you over the top. And Mike Brown was the guy. Like I said, they don't talk enough about how he changed the offensive philosophy after the Atlanta game. The Atlanta series was the toughest of all the series that the Knicks have played. And then Cat now has confidence. Cat knows that he's the key. And then we haven't even talked about Jalen Brunson, who is probably the top athlete now in New York City. And the one guy who I really like, who's a favorite of mine, is OG Anunoby, who just is a he goes about his business, comes up clutch, same with heart. This is going to be an unbelievable series. It really is.
Yep.
And I can't imagine what Madison Square Garden is going to be like for game 3 and 4. I mean, I don't, especially imagine if they take the first two in San Antonio, which I don't think will happen.
No,
If
I
they
don't
get
think it'll
the
happen either.
split, then that game 3 is going to be off the charts. Now, we remember the 90s, how when the Knicks were good. I tell people this all the time. They don't understand. The Knicks are 1A and the Yankees are 1B in popularity of sports teams in New York City. They are the top two when they're neck and neck. Because people, I mean, I'm an old guy. I saw the Knicks win in 69. I saw them win in 73. Basketball in New York City is religion. It really is.
Yep.
St. John's now, Rick Pitino, God bless him. There's the Renaissance of St. John's. This is how it was like in the 80s with St. John's on the Glukana. It's basketball is king in New York City, and baseball comes next, then football, then hockey. But the Knicks are, if the Knicks win this championship, I am not leaving Staten Island for about a week until it dies down, because that Manhattan is going to be on fire.
I know. Well, I'm out in Suffolk County, so I'm safe. I'll watch from
So,
my humble abode and I will enjoy it, but I will not go near. Yeah, all right, I won't go near. Listen, man, this is.
will I
Go
be
ahead.
surprised if the Knicks win? No, but I'm picking Spurs in 6.
So you're picking Spurs in six. I'm picking Knicks in six. Andy, I hope that was enough basketball analysis. Now, here's the question. Steve, enjoy your night. Thank you for coming on this Sunday night. I always enjoy catching up with you. I miss our weekly podcast. Maybe we do something again, and they could tell us about how we're two old farts and we could go yell and go on our
Hey,
lawns, and that's the end of the ball game. You go enjoy retirement, my man.
I'm available now all the time. We just give me the
All
heads up and I'm ready to roll. It's been a pleasure,
right.
Mike. I always enjoy your company and talking to you.
Same
Great.
here. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Enjoy your Sunday,
Okay,
my
Mike.
friend. That's
You
a good
too. Take
buddy,
care.
my buddy Steve Keen. Hopefully you enjoyed him here on the show. All right, that's it. Long mailbag. We got into a lot of stuff, including Knicks. Hope you enjoyed Andrew Moscato and the Zen of Bobby V. Getting a chance to learn a little bit about Bobby V on a different level. And of course, you know, we kicked it off talking about the pitching and really what I think is the key. Mets had an interesting month of May against inferior competition, 92 win pace. Now it gets a little bit harder here in June. Let's see what these kids are made of. Let's see the development of Benj and Ewing. Let's see if the starting pitching and the young pitchers could continue to do their part. And that's how I'm taking the rest of the season. Let's see. This is not about counting how they could get into the playoffs. This is not about, you know, what they need to do to be a contending team by August 1st. They're not. They're a team that has to prove that they have some foundational homegrown pieces that actually matter. All right, that's it. Thanks for checking me out. You can check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNOG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NOG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And come join me at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Leave me a 5-star review if you can on Spotify or Apple. Greatly appreciated. Why not? This is probably your favorite show. Till next time, take care, everybody.